From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Bowie State University in Prince George's County, one of the oldest historically black universities in the country, is celebrating its 150th anniversary. We explore its origins as a one-room schoolhouse in Baltimore to its evolution into a university with close to 6,000 students and talk to an alumna who's 106 years old. Then, how do you write a character who was born one race and then becomes another? Tom Hall speaks with author Jess Rowe, who examines race and identity in his novel, Your Face in Mine. Plus, we talk to UMBC physicist Vanderlee Martens about how a tiny satellite you could hold in your hands, called a CubeSat, is about to make us smarter about the weather by monitoring Earth's clouds from space. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning, it's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The educational institution we know as Bowie State University is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. The university opened its doors as a one-room schoolhouse in Baltimore while the Civil War was still being fought in January 1865. Over 15 decades, it has evolved into a university of close to 6,000 students. In a few minutes, we'll learn some of its early history and why it moved from Baltimore to Bowie from archivist Katie Hayes. First, let's hear from a woman who lived part of Bowie State's history, Beatrice Payne. She graduated from Bowie in 1928. Producer Jonna McCone and I visited Mrs. Payne in February.
I am Beatrice Payne, and I am 105 years old. I grew up in Baltimore County. My father was a truck farmer, which meant that he raised vegetables and every Saturday took them into Bel Air Market to sell. So my experience as a youngster was in the country. I climbed trees, I rode horseback, I played with the animals. I did all of the things that a little country girl would do and more. If I would remember correctly, we had about 30 children, and those 30 children were in 8 grades. It was Hartley's Elementary School. That was a one-room school. We went from first grade to the 8th grade. And as a result of that, when I went to Bowie, instead of entering freshman, I entered second year high. My father's youngest brother was a teacher. In fact, he was my teacher at the Hartley Elementary School. And when it was time to make a decision as to what I should do after school, he suggested that I go to Bowie. I was hoping that it would lead me to teaching. Many of the family members in my family were teachers. And I thought that was just wonderful, and so I wanted to be a teacher. I had to complete my high school education first, and I did that, which was 3 years of high school training at Bowie. And by that time, they had created the normal school at Bowie, which was 2-year teaching training. And so when I finished the 3-year high, I went right back to Bowie for 2-year normal, where I would be training to be a teacher.
That was Beatrice Payne, who graduated from Bowie Teachers College 87 years ago. We spoke in February. At that time, we also spoke with archivist Katie Hayes. For the past 5 years, she's been looking through old yearbooks, photographs, and newspaper articles as part of efforts to organize the university's archives. I asked her to walk us through how Bowie State got started as a school in Baltimore City several decades before Beatrice Payne went there.
Well, at the end of the Civil War, the state of Maryland had simultaneously liberated all enslaved peoples in Maryland and adopted a new state constitution. And that included the ability to tax citizens and provide free public education for everyone. Now, of course, education was not integrated then, and it was not explicitly allowed for African-American residents. And so there were groups of businessmen, lawyers, clergymen who had been abolitionists and then emancipationists, what they called emancipationists then during the Civil War, who kind of publicly lobbied for support of African-American education, which was not something that they could accomplish on the public level. But so they formed a group called the Baltimore Association for the Moral and Educational Improvement of Colored People. And this group decided to collect funds and provide for the education of African-Americans. And one of the schools that they founded, and they had many schools throughout the state of Maryland within the 6 years that they existed, but one of them was in a building called Crane's Building in downtown Baltimore in the northwest corner of Calvert and Saratoga. And this had been the site of a former African Baptist church. So they started collecting funds through donations, through Quaker meetings all up and down the East Coast, and many Northeastern Freedmen's Associations to provide payment for teachers to start schooling and creating a codified education for African Americans.
And so was it focused on elementary students or high school, or were those distinctions not even made?
Yeah, there wasn't really a distinction, because before emancipation nationally, it was considered illegal to educate enslaved people, so any kind of education was what they were seeking. There was no level at this point. In fact, education itself was not standardized until much later.
So how long did the school stay in downtown Baltimore?
I believe until it moved up to Bowie.
Which was when?
The land was purchased in 1908, and the school itself opened in 1911.
And why? Do you have any idea why it moved to rural Prince George's County from urban
Baltimore? I can only guess. Some of the attractions were that it was centrally located. It was designed to attract students from all over. There was a railroad line right there, so students could get there from Washington, from Baltimore, and from southern Maryland, which had a huge African-American population because of the agricultural nature of the state.
What had it been called in Baltimore, and what was it called when it moved to Bowie?
After it was called the Baltimore Normal School for Colored Teachers, it became the Baltimore Normal School No. 3. It was the third normal school for teachers, created in Maryland. The first two were white, Towson and Frostburg. And then it became the Maryland Normal and Industrial School at Bowie. This was when it opened at Bowie in 1911. And after that, it became Maryland Teachers College, then Bowie State College in 1963. That's when they started offering a liberal arts education. And then in 1988, it joined the University System of Maryland and became a university.
That's Katie Hayes, an archivist with Bowie State University, here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Bowie State's history. Beatrice Payne was 14 when she left Baltimore County. Her uncle Elijah, her teacher, encouraged her and paid her first year's room and board. Beatrice took the train to Bowie. It was a sleepy rural town, and she shared her memories with us of the school's culture and top-notch teachers.
We had a glee club. We had the football team. We had everything that a normal high school would have. Going to Bowie was the first time that I had been away from home without the other members of my family. Life at Bowie was really very home-like. We were more like a family, and we had excellent teachers. I'm remembering, for instance, one teacher, Miss Josephine Brown. She was our English teacher, and you had to do everything as it was supposed to be done. If you were given a paper to write, you had to write that paper, and you made sure you checked it and punctuation marks and everything where they should be. She was an excellent teacher.
First of all, was it at that time, was it funded by the state?
Yes. The Baltimore Association disbanded in 1870, and the state took over support of the schools while it was still in Baltimore. And then Joseph Cushing, who was a member of that group, had lobbied in the legislature to get the school to be opened in Bowie, on, you know, for the state to actually purchase the land and create a more permanent institution.
Were teaching requirements different for African Americans than for white teachers?
Well, education for teachers wasn't as codified for them. And yes, it took a while. The school started out being a high school, as Beatrice said, and then it gradually evolved. The first four-year graduating class did not graduate till 1941. So standards were a little different. I think the school evolved more slowly, probably due to lack of real concrete support. There were many mentions in some of the documentation about deteriorating facilities. One of the original buildings burned down in 1922. You know, there was a lot of change and growth going on, and I think it was a struggle.
Beatrice had already been teaching 25 years by 1954 when the U.S. Supreme Court issued its verdict in Brown v. Board of Education, declaring separate schools for blacks and whites unconstitutional. Mrs. Payne told us what she observed after Brown.
The children that I had been teaching up at Sparks Elementary for 25 years went down to the integrated school, all except 12. And that whole year, I taught 12 children. That's all I had. They had gone down to the integrated school. And then at the end of that year, that was when they closed the Sparks school and sent me down to Fleming Elementary to teach special ed. And so I went there and worked with the special ed class. So I taught the special ed class down there for 2 years. And then they sent me to Towson Elementary, which was a 32-room school. And in that 32 rooms, there were 16 special ed classes. So I was administrative assistant and special ed supervisor.
How did Bowie change after Brown v. Board?
I don't have a lot of documentation on that level, although there are indications in some of the catalogs where they used to list graduates what their race was. It gradually became integrated. I think locally there were students that was the best option for them. And then, of course, in the 60s with the growth of the civil rights movement, there were a lot of white students that wanted to go to a black school to kind of further the cause of integration.
In going through the archives, is there a document or something that you came upon that really struck you as you're celebrating the 150th anniversary?
Oh, there's so many. We just got done organizing all the photographs, and we have some beautiful historic photographs. It's hard to pinpoint one thing. One of my favorite things that I first found early on was a commencement program in the shape of a fan. And it's the old kind of fan, which is a cutout piece of cardboard that's printed with the events of the commencement on it and a stick stapled onto the back of it. And that's because commencement was held outside, and it was, of course, very hot.
I appreciate you talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Katie Hayes is an archivist at Bowie State University. We spoke in February. Earlier, we heard from Bowie graduate Beatrice Payne, who celebrated her 106th birthday this spring. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us on 88.1.
Join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Rachel Dolezal, the former NAACP chapter president in Spokane, Washington, is a Caucasian woman who has famously said that she, quote, identifies as black. Last fall, I spoke with the author Jess Rowe about his novel Your Face in Mine, which takes up this very issue of racial identification. Set in Baltimore, one of the protagonists, Martin Lipkin, is white and Jewish. Before the novel begins, he has self-diagnosed himself with what he calls racial identity dysphoria syndrome, and he has undergone racial reassignment surgery to become African American. As Martin's story is revealed, Jess Rowe explores what it would be like to live your life as a completely new person, not unlike what Miss Dolezal did until her parents corrected the record. There are other issues that Jess Rowe considers in his debut novel, issues like white privilege and police brutality, even gender identity. We spoke long before Rachel Dolezal, Freddie Gray, and Caitlyn Jenner became household names, but the resonance of those people and their experiences is clear in this fascinating book. Jess Rowe joined me on the line from New York last October. So to give folks a little idea of the setup of the book, introduce us to Martin Wilkinson and Kelly Thorndike, your two protagonists.
These are two two men who grew up in Baltimore together in the early 1990s. They were teenagers in high school in the early 1990s, and they were in a band together. They went to the same private high school. Slightly outside the city, but they had a very active life in the city in the underground music scene. And after high school, a very tragic thing happened to them. They were in a band that was three people, and the third member of the band, whose name was Alan, their mutual best friend, died of a drug overdose. And after that, their lives, Martin's life and Kelly's life, took very different paths. Kelly went on to Amherst and then moved to China and then went to Harvard and got a PhD in Chinese literature and became a public radio employee when academia didn't pan out. And he's lived away from Baltimore for many, many years. He comes back to Baltimore after another tragedy in his life. His wife, who's Chinese, and young daughter are killed in a car accident in Cambridge, where they're living. And he, out of desperation, comes back to Baltimore for a public radio job because he really has nowhere else to go, and he's sort of looking to regenerate himself. He's at Mondawmin Mall in sort of a, what to him is sort of a random location, not someplace that he goes very often. And a black man approaches him across the parking lot, and it turns out that black man is Martin, who he hasn't seen in 20 years and who, when he last saw him, was a 20-year-old or 19-year-old white Jewish kid named Martin Lipkin, and now is an adult African-American man, a successful entrepreneur who's married to a black woman, has black children, lives a very established life in the community. And what nobody knows about Martin Wilkinson is that he was a white teenager who underwent this crisis and decided that he had this racial identity dysphoria syndrome, that he's transracial, and went to Thailand and had racial reassignment surgery, found a kind of renegade surgeon who did the surgery on him to transform him into what from the outside is the appearance of an ordinary black person, a person you would see anywhere on the street.
This syndrome, for example, racial identity dysphoria syndrome, and the notion of a racial reassignment surgery, surgically changing someone's race, is that real or is that a product of your imagination?
It's a little bit of both. When I started thinking about this book, I was reading another book about the history of plastic surgery and the invention of rhinoplasty, of the nose job, which was invented by a German surgeons, some of whom were Jewish, in the 19th century. And when I was reading, I was just sort of leafing through that book, it came to me that in our culture, in our time, one very well could come up with a notion of racial dysphoria or racial reassignment surgery. And it, to me, at that moment, it seemed like this isn't really that surprising. It's not something that exists in the world, but it could exist. And that's sort of where I began thinking through the novel from the premise of such a thing could exist, and the conditions in some ways are right for it, but it doesn't exist yet. So I felt like I'd sort of put my finger on something that I felt like was sort of just about to happen.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to my conversation last fall with the author Jess Rowe about his novel Your Face in Mine. When Rachel Dolezal's racial identity became known, many people drew parallels between her experience and that of another person who's been in the news lately, Caitlyn Jenner, whom some see as the new face of the transgender community. In Jess Rowe's novel, Martin says he is, quote, a black man in a white man's body. I asked Jess Rowe about what leads Martin to come to that conclusion and if his journey is similar to that of transgender people.
You know, that's a difficult question to answer. I think that transgender people come from all different kinds of backgrounds and experiences. For Martin, what happens is that he grows up in a kind of eccentric family situation. His father is a gay man. His mother he was born on a commune down near Edgewater in rural Maryland in the 1970s. And his mother left very soon after his birth. So he was raised by his father, who's a gay man, and a very, almost a sort of a claustrophobic person who lives near Greenmount Avenue in that section of the city, in a mostly African-American section of the city. And Martin begins his life going to a fictional elementary school in that neighborhood where he's the only white child. So he has an experience from early in life of identifying very closely with black people and really finding that a lot of the parental figures in his life and the closest friends and the people he's most intimate with are black people. And then as he moves along through his life, he winds up in what's called the Willow School in the novel, which is the private school outside the city, which is overwhelmingly white and upper middle class and academic. And it's that the dysphoria for him, as he describes it himself, the dysphoria begins there. He has this feeling of origins in the black community and even a sense of childhood selfhood in that community. And then he experiences this huge disjunct with the person he's brought up to be when he enters, essentially when he enters the white world. And then in his early 20s, he has some depression. He doesn't know what to do with his life. He's involved in kind of low-level and then higher-level crime. He has a real sense of crisis of identity, and it comes to him sort of as a shock that this could be the solution to his problems.
Because this whole question of identity and what comprises identity is something that is constantly on the reader's mind during this novel. I mean, what do you think the ingredients of identity are if they're not race, if they're not ethnicity, if they're not gender for that matter? How do people establish what their identity is?
Well, I mean, I think I would never say it's not those things. I have to say I think those elements, gender and sexuality and race, or you know, perceived race or ethnicity, cultural origins, socioeconomic origins, those are all huge components of our identity. What I think in the sort of thinking that went into this novel, and I think the thinking that came out of the novel for me, is that these things are much more fluid than we ordinarily assume them to be. And that there's more sort of choice. There's more room in our lives for manipulation of our own identities than we normally think there is. And for me, some of that experience comes from having lived outside the United States and experiencing the way that people in other parts of the world, especially Asia, have a different sense of identity, and also a different sense of the fluidity of identity.
If we take just the single issue of treatment of black people by police departments across the country. We have LeVar Ferguson in South Carolina. We've got Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. We've got a gentleman named Colin Truss here in Baltimore. The city of Baltimore has paid nearly $6 million, according to a Sun investigative report just a few days ago, since 2011 to settle police brutality cases. Are you taking up the matter of whether it's easier to be white than it is to be a person of color? And if so, it seems like it's not much of a leap to go from easier to better. And is that troublesome?
Well, it is troublesome, and I would say absolutely it is easier to be a person. It is easier to be a white person in the United States than a person of color in so many ways. And part of what I wanted to do in this novel was have, you know, often passing narratives in American culture have to do with a person of color trying to become white. And what I wanted to do with this book was reverse the equation, because I really wanted to draw attention to the sort of the desires that draw white people away from whiteness out of a sense of guilt, out of a sense of not knowing what whiteness is, out of a sense of discomfort with privilege and power. But all that said, there can never be any mistaking the fact that, you know, whiteness is a place, is a position of privilege and power. And it's very easy for white people to forget that. I would say, you know, I'm not a police officer and I'm not involved in policing, but I think there's a certain element in modern policing, part of what's being called the sort of militarization of policing, that has to do with setting the police apart from the community that they belong to. And this, I think, is the most radical kind of mistake, because I think the most basic thing that we all have to embrace, that we all have to come to accept in one way or another, is that we are part of the same human family, and that everybody has a mother, everybody has a father, and that everybody deserves to be treated with dignity. And if you don't start policing with that philosophy in mind, then policing just reinforces the power structure that we already experience. You know, policing should be used to protect people from the power structure, not reinforce it. But we've fallen into a pattern where policing reproduces the power structure.
Jess Rowe talking with me about his debut novel, Your Face in Mine. We spoke in October of 2014. We've got details about the book on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
Issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover, let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Now we're going to take a look back at an innovation in how we monitor the Earth from space. Dr. Vanderlee Martens is a professor of physics at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC. In February 2015, we spoke with Dr. Martens about a type of satellite called a CubeSat, so small you could carry it in a backpack. Martens is the principal investigator of a project that uses this technology. He's working with students, professors, and NASA engineers and scientists to build a CubeSat that will investigate aerosol particles and clouds in the atmosphere. We began with the obvious. What is a CubeSat?
So a CubeSat is a very small satellite, and the idea was conceived in the end of the 90s, that we would have a satellite that basically you can fit in your hands. So the one cube of the CubeSat is 40 inches by 40 inches by 40 inches and weighs about 1 kilogram or slightly over 2 pounds. So if you put three of them together in line, you have basically the shape of a loaf of bread that you can now fit with instrumentation, and then you send it to space to do some sort of measurement of interest.
The White House has a goal to have, that every state should have a CubeSat in space. Where are we in reaching that goal?
So the CubeSat is a small enough satellite that usually is made by students at universities. And that can allow, you know, as the White House has this goal, that every state has its own CubeSat in space, doing some sort of science or engineering test. And we are pretty close to that. I think most states are reaching that level.
And other than being smaller, how do CubeSats compare to other satellites, regular satellites?
So regular satellite is much bigger spacecraft that you can put more instrumentation, so you can have more power collected from bigger solar panels in space, and you have more resources to do more measurements. So for instance, we have satellites looking at weather, we have satellites looking at clouds, looking at pollution, looking at the ocean, so there are many applications. So a CubeSat is a similar type of spacecraft, but of a much smaller size. So you have less resources in a CubeSat. So it's also a much cheaper type of satellite.
And how is a CubeSat launched?
So it's launched similarly to the bigger satellites, except that you don't have your own rocket for a small CubeSat. So usually you take a ride with a bigger payload. So when they are launching bigger satellites, they usually have space left. They actually need some ballast, so they need some additional weight in different parts of the rocket to balance it. So one of the ideas of the CubeSat was to use this space and to use this opportunity to put small experiments
in
space.
It's kind of a free ride.
It's kind of a free ride, except it's never free.
It does a lot. On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Dr. Vanderlei Martens, professor of physics at UMBC. We're talking about a project he leads that studies aerosol particles and clouds to better understand climate change. I've just stepped on what I wanted to ask you. What will your CubeSat study?
So our CubeSat is designed to measure aerosol particles and cloud particles. So aerosols are small particles in suspension in the atmosphere, so basically dust or pollution particles that could come from smoke, from forest fires, for instance, or emissions from factories or from cars. So these are basically small particles, liquid and solid particles in suspension in the atmosphere. Now, these particles are very important for Earth's atmosphere. So as an example, there would be no clouds on Earth if it wasn't for aerosol particles. So for the water vapor in the atmosphere to form droplets and eventually form clouds, they need these particles. So the water vapor condenses around these particles and grow as cloud droplets.
So I just feel the need to say the obvious. A lot of us think of aerosols as something that comes out of a spray can. Aerosol means much more than that to a scientist.
Aerosol is much more than that. So what comes out of a aerosol can is called aerosol also, but any of these particles, liquid or solid particles in suspension in the atmosphere, is what we call aerosol. So when you look at the window and the sunlight is entering the room and you see those particles floating around, so those particles are aerosol particles.
So why study aerosols and clouds?
As I was saying, aerosols have a lot of effects in the atmosphere. So one of them is the radiative balance or the energy balance of the planet. So when solar light comes to Earth and warms up Earth, it first interacts with the atmosphere. So these aerosol particles in suspension in the atmosphere can, first of all, reflect sunlight back to space, causing a cooling effect on the atmosphere. Or, depending on the particle, they could absorb sunlight in the atmosphere, causing a warming effect on the atmosphere. So aerosols, first of all, can interact with this energy balance of the planet. Second is what I was saying initially. So because aerosols are essential for the formation of clouds in the atmosphere, aerosols have a direct link with precipitation. So if you have a region where you have more aerosols, you are going to have different types or different characteristics of the clouds and precipitation than you have when you look at a region that has less aerosols or it's cleaner.
So I'm not sure I understand what your CubeSat is going to learn from these clouds.
So our CubeSat is very high up in space, 400 kilometers away, looking at Earth and basically making images of Earth. So very large images of Earth, measuring different colors of light or wavelengths, and also measuring what we call polarization. So with this information, we can tell the amount of aerosols that you have in the atmosphere and the type of aerosols that we have in the atmosphere. We also can tell some properties of the clouds. So you can look at how much cloud cover you have in a given region, and we can measure the size of the droplets in the cloud. By knowing the size of the droplets in the cloud, we can study how efficiently that cloud can behave in terms of precipitation. Is it going to rain in a given place or not? We're not going to be able to make that prediction with our measurements, but we will collect statistics that will help us to understand how the whole system works.
How did you decide that a CubeSat was the right tool for you to use to explore these questions?
So we use also bigger satellites to make these measurements. So we have now satellites in space that are on the size of a school bus, completely full of instruments, doing all sorts of measurements. And we need them. So we will continue in that direction. On the other hand, a CubeSat is a small satellite at a much lower cost, where you can test new ideas, where you can develop new instrumentation, and then send it to space and do those measurements. That eventually, we also want those measurements in bigger satellites. But if we can do that first in a CubeSat, we can develop it further, so we can learn much more.
Does this small technology, this CubeSat, get students more involved in your research?
We definitely have more students involved in CubeSat, because if you are building a CubeSat, you can take more risk. So you can, because it's a much cheaper satellite than the bigger ones, you end up taking more risk, you end up investing more in innovation, you end up involving more younger scientists and younger engineers in developing this type of project.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Vanderlei Martens, professor of physics at UMBC. He talked to us about a collaborative CubeSat program he leads called HARP, for Hyperangular Rainbow Polarimeter. We spoke in March. We've got more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Mary Wiltenberg,
Christy Forrest,
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in history, 1892, James M. Cain, author of The Postman Always Rings Twice and Mildred Pierce, was born in Annapolis. We're back Friday. Hope you'll join us.